I'm Ben Solak, and I host the Ringer NFL Draft Show with Danny Kelly, Danny Heifetz, and Craig Horbeck. Join us twice a week as we talk everything NFL draft and break down all the players who will make your team better. Except the Rams, because they don't really have any picks. Check us out on the Ringer NFL Draft Show on Spotify.
There's no better feeling than a personal win, and the State Farm Personal Price Plan can help you do just that. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
On today's One Sickly Podcast, I am your host, Tate Frazier, and first and foremost, I want to apologize to all the friends of the program that have been keeping up with the rigorous schedule of the NCAA tournament on One Shining Podcast. My goal was to be there and react right when things happen so that we can dump our thoughts and react and talk about things that are happening. But unfortunately, yesterday I ended up with a 105-degree fever and a sore throat, so that's not the best for recording. Again, it probably doesn't sound like I am a clean bill of health right now. But look, it's the Elite Eight. We got to react to what's happening in college basketball. We got three teams that have never made a Final Four on their way. We got UConn back in the Final Four. I got Kyle Mann, who is healthy, on the microphone to break it all down with me. This is going to be a very fun show. This is One Shining Podcast. Appreciate everyone's patience, and let's get into it. But first, Woody Durham.
He takes the timeout.
They're out of
timeout. Technical foul. Technical foul.
All right. Welcome in. This is One Shining Podcast, and if you can't tell by my voice, yes, I am very, very sick, and I've been under the weather, and luckily for me, I have a great producer, and I have a great co-host here, and Kyle Mann. They both, they saw me last night, and they said, not tonight, not tonight, and I went home, had a 105-degree fever, struggled with that, but I woke up today, the voice is a little bit better, and probably doesn't sound so great to everyone at home, but we had a great basketball games. There's no time to be sick. And Kyle Mann sitting across from me, we just saw a great game, Texas, Miami. Let's start there. We'll get into all the details of this, but what an amazing game. I felt like Texas dominated the game, but we come away with Jim Larrañaga's second Final Four as a head coach. He went to a couple Final Fours under Terry Holland when he was at Virginia, but also the first Final Four in Miami history. So let's start there, Kyle, man. And thanks so much for putting up with my voice and my sickness and all the other things going on in my life.
At 105, is your brain like melting at that point? Is this one of those like your brain kind of becomes like an egg in a skillet where you you had a look in your eyes? You said it was more of a visual thing. Kyle and I both saw you had a sort of this virus has punched me. I'm wobbling a little bit.
Right.
I'm leaning on the ropes. You had that.
It was a rocky fight. A rocky fight, and I was going up against Dolph Lundgren, and he was knocking me out. And funny enough, my girlfriend, she just like pulled the sheets up yesterday, and she's like, "You're on fire." And then got the thermometer, took my temperature.
Usually that means something else. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, right. That would be much better. But yeah, that time it was 102. And then as the day wore on, it got to 105. But eventually last night, the fever broke and we're all good. We got good basketball to talk about. So enough about my health. This game started out pretty wild. A 9-2 run for Miami. It looked great for Miami. I love the versatility of Jordan Miller. And then all of a sudden, the Texas bench, right, they had 21 points in the first half. They seemed like they just kind of took over this game. They were dominating. And all of a sudden, things started to change as we get in the second half. But what was your big takeaway just from the Texas side of things? Because I've seen a lot of people talking about Texas got screwed by the officials, this, this, and that. But in general, I didn't think Texas really threw this game away. I just thought Miami kept scratching and clawing and then found a way to win in the end.
No, I mean, I think it kind of went both ways. Like you and I talked about early in the game, you know, I thought Texas was getting a pretty good whistle when they were sort of establishing the temperature. There's a buzzword for us today. When they were kind of setting the temperature of how physical this game was going to be early on, I had the thought, I was just like, I just don't, I don't see this happening for Miami today. Like it just looked like the way it was being officiated, that it was going to be in Texas' favor. And early on in the game, you know, it was kind of some back and forth. We saw a little bit of Jordan, like it was an interesting sort of pulling the DHO ISO situation where the bigs were just kept taking each other off the dribble, whether it was Bishop for Texas or Jordan Miller for Miami. The game really started that way, where you got the sense that he really liked his matchup. Miami, yeah, I mean, it just felt like throughout this game, I think I texted you, I mean, what's the time stamp on that? It was like 12 minutes to go. I texted you, it was just like, this isn't happening. It was just like, you know, Texas and Miami defensively just profile as very different teams. You know, I like to look at how teams defend in the middle to the late part of the shot clock, and Miami is very middle of the road in that way. They're, you know, like 42nd percentile-ish, but they're awesome in the late clock offensively because they have those scores. You know, the fact that they have Isaiah Wong, the fact that they have Nigel Pack and then Jordan Miller. But Texas has been amazing throughout the year, and especially in the last few games, defending in the middle of the clock because their cohesiveness throughout this game. I thought they thoroughly outplayed Miami throughout this game, but Miami just kind of was spinning plates with their individual scores. To me, I thought like a turning point in the game was that Carr injury. Did you sense that? It kind of sensed like our on-court leader, our defensive sort of anchor, the head of the snake. It looked bad when he went down and he was kind of grabbing the front of his knee and he had that, you know, you want to talk about I'm on the ropes look in your eyes. Carr had him. It looked bad. I thought he was really hurt.
Yeah, and he went over to the bike at that point. They cut to his family in the crowd. Shout out to his brother that had the Vince Carter Toronto Raptors throwback shirt on. Yeah. I love that. But yeah, when that happened, like you said, Carr had done such a great job on Wong defensively at that point. And, you know, he was, you know, kind of initiating the offense. He was the X factor, the threat for Texas. Serge Ibari Rice, our guy, was unbelievable in this game, too. But the two of them, they ended up putting Rice on Wong later in the game because of Carr's injury. I felt like that was a big thing. I just want to say as a kind of big, you know, big picture note on this game, this was high level basketball. And a perfect example of that is, look, Texas scored 8 of their last 9 possessions to close out the first half. And that included a Marcus Carr foul 3 at the end. And Miami shot 64% and they were down 8 at the half. Right. I mean, that just goes to show you how good of a game this was. And when Carr went down, There just felt to be like a little bit of a panic. And obviously Norchad Omier was in foul trouble. And when Larrañaga pulled him and put him on the bench when he picked up his fourth foul, it, you know, weirdly, I thought in my mind, unfortunately, that's game. You know, that's what we do on the show. I thought that was going to be it. But as it started to play out, I realized that Jordan Miller playing basically as like a de facto 5, but he's so versatile defensively. That to me was the real game changer. And, you know, if you didn't know Jordan Miller's name before today, you have to know it now. I mean, the guy shot 100% from the field, 100% from the free throw line, 13 of 13 from the free throw line, and has 27 points. And if you remember last year in the Elite Eight when they lost to Kansas, Jordan Miller after the game was devastated. He was absolutely just thrown for a loop. He just felt like he was dejected, all the adjectives you can think of. And I think the larger level, you know, intrigue with this Miami team is they go out in the portal, they bring in Nigel Pack. They thought that was the one key cog they really needed. And Pack kept them in the game until, you know, we got into the later stages, like the last 10 minutes of the second half. He was the one that really kept everything within reach, right? That's all Miami was trying to do. Like you said, they're spinning plates. They're trying to hold on for dear life. And Nigel Pack gave them that. And then as we got into the stretch run of the game, Jordan Miller, Isaiah Wong hit some really tough shots. And then Miami, Norchad Omier was amazing down the stretch. And kind of the rest is history. But I still can't believe they were in the game. You know, like when the run started to happen, I cannot believe they were in the game. Yeah.
I couldn't either. I think around that time of the game, when they cut it to 6, I was just like, I can't believe this is happening. And you definitely, I'll say this, one of the things on the season the thing that has been a hallmark of this team is the fact that they can get to the line. They're not like outstanding at it, but they really, really delivered. They're a great foul shooting team on the season, 77.6. And today, you know, they average 18.1 free throw attempts per game. And today they got to the line when they really, really needed to get there. They got 32 free throw attempts and they hit 28 of them. So they surpassed their number and their average. And that was the thing that, you know, you talked about that physical style that was established early. It started to kind of tilt Miami's direction in that sense. And that, you know, I really think that their creators, Pac, to his credit, didn't force it. I didn't feel like Texas was doing an awesome job. Like the opposite sides of the ball here really tell a big story in that, like, Miami, when you really start to stretch their help defense and their rotations, you saw them just, their effort isn't always there in transition. It's right. Like they just kind of, they like to trade buckets. They guard. It's not like they don't guard at all. But Texas, I really felt like did a great job in the first half of pushing Wong to his left. And I noticed when Carr went out, Wong, he started to do that. I was thinking too, like 04, kind of Ben Gordon is another guy who was like this, where he just has that really powerful right hand and deceleration. You know, you watch like the mass, like Luka's a master of deceleration. Kyrie's like, it's a really one-on-one score. It's a trait that a lot of those guys have. But Wong got into a rhythm and you could just kind of feel Miami's whole offense come to life. When that happened, they like started to believe. But yeah, it just seemed like Miami, once they started to get their momentum, and they got some key deflections, I thought. They kind of started trapping the ball a little bit at half court, and that got them rolling. And I don't know. It just seemed like once that happened, Texas just didn't have as many easy answers as Miami did.
Yeah, I mean, it was 72-68 with 6:58 to play. Texas takes a timeout, and at that point in time, you started to feel, you know, if you believe in momentum, some people think momentum is made up. I personally believe in it. I felt like there started to be a sort of change in the vibe of the building. Felt like anything was possible. And then from that point, we get a Wong is, like you said, he started to get into a rhythm a little bit, and then he gets downhill. They're expecting him to take that little mid-range jumper, and instead he throws a lob to Omir, who gets the dunk and one. They take the lead 73-72, and then all of a sudden we got a game, right? And down the stretch, Miami continued to execute. They continued to run sets for their main guys, whether it be Miller, isolation. I thought Miller in isolation was amazing for Miami. I thought he was a big difference for them, and they got a great call on a block that, you know, some people said could have been in charge there late on Allen, but I thought it was a block. I didn't think he got there. But in general, Miami executed down the stretch as a team, and I felt like Texas, when it got tight down the stretch, they started to play hero ball a little bit. You know, everybody, Marcus Carr, you know, the steal late in this game on Carr that Omir had, he had Serge Ibari Rice, our guy, an OSP, or, you know, to this day, he had him wide open for a three. And, you know, Serge Ibari Rice, every time he shoots a three, you think it's going to go in. So the fact that Carr didn't make that pass, I felt like the worst tendencies of Texas, their individual talent started to show itself at the end, as far as everyone wanted to be the one that was going to win the game for them. And Miami at that point was like, whatever it takes to win the game. And we got to talk about the most controversial call, because you and I were texting about Brock Cunningham. He's such a glue guy. He's such an X factor, whatever you want to call him for Texas. But this box out on Omir, which would have been Omir's fifth foul if it was called on him, he jumps up in the air, which, you know, some people were saying it was over the back. But Brock Cunningham, in my opinion, it was a pretty dangerous play where he continues to bolt back to take away his landing area. Omir comes down. Mm-hmm. Originally, they said it was Omir's fifth foul, and then they recant and change the call, say it's on Cunningham. He gets the free throws. And then the next possession, Texas comes down, Omir gets the steal, and the rest is history. And Omir doesn't get that steal, right? Come over to help if he's out of the game and he fouls out. So I understand the Texas vantage point for, you know, when you look at it that way. But at the same time, Cunningham, that was a dangerous play in my opinion, but it was kind of like that was the final nail in the coffin for this game. And I wanted to get your thoughts on Brock Cunningham in general, and then just that play specifically.
Yeah, it's been, you know, today and last night a little bit, we've had some, you don't you know, games don't come down to a single play. That's, you know, it's it can seem that way, obviously, in the drama, the way games unfold. I thought it was pretty funny how is it Stratori, the referee, the TV ref? What's his name? Jim
Tessitore.
Is that his name?
Stratori.
Yeah. It was just funny to hear him say, you know, we could sit back and dissect plays all day. It's like, yeah, that's what you're paid to do. So,
right. Gene, isn't that your job? Right. You come into this every single day and you do this. Yeah.
I always think it's funny him and Steve Javy. I'm like, yeah, I mean, having like the fraternity of referees is just so strong. I'm like, yeah, we could also have like the Shark do like a commentary on Jaws, and I'm sure we would get objective commentary there. But yeah, I mean, Cunningham throughout this game, I mean, his rebounding was a big part of the game. He was sort of a really important glue guy for them. Only 7 points, but he had 8 rebounds. You know, five of them were offensive, and they were backbreakers. But I thought like the speed of Miami's front court. We saw a lot of that against Houston. I thought tonight that it kind of started to play a factor later in the game. I mean, Miami just kind of, they manufacture offense differently than Texas does. In this game, Miami, I had it in front of me just a second ago. Let's see. Yeah, 19 overall isolations in this game. So they lean and 1.105 points per possession on that, whereas Texas only did 6. So they don't really manufacture offense schematically the same way that Texas does. Texas usually tries to work together and create their offense, but Miami does it a little bit differently. I was going to comment. I think that we need to at least pay homage to Serge Ibari Rice's pump fake, which I'm convinced.
Oh, yeah.
Could raise the dead. I'm pretty sure if he like was walking through a graveyard and pump faked, like bodies would be reanimated. That's how powerful it is. I
bite on it at home. Like I literally would be on my couch and he does. It's a pass fake and a shot fake. He has both, but every time he does it, you're like, you got me again. And of course, defenders jump every time because he sells it so well. And I mean, he had a big drive and finish late in the game on a shot fake, you know. And of course, because he's such a good shooter, you have to bite on it. You have to give it its credit. But you're right. That's a staple. I feel like NBA scouts, when they see Serge Ibari Rice, they got to respect that.
Yeah, I think he did a lot for his argument to play in the league. And it kind of, this is a weird comp, but like from a big to a small, like that, like it reminds me of Jokic's pump fake, which is like weirdly exaggerated. And you're always just like, why do people always fall for it? There's something about it that you always fall for, but
It's the commitment, Kyle. It's the commitment every single time. If you commit to it, then they believe. That's all it is. That's all it takes. So shout out to Serge Ibari Rice. There was one other thing I wanted to point out in this game that I thought was fascinating. Nigel Pack, he hit the Larry Bird shot over the backboard,
It
was waved off. That's a college rule, and I feel like we haven't seen that in a while. So I just wanted to give him a tip of the cap because – one, we should get rid of that rule, and two, that should have counted in my book. So for all the people that are upset about Miami winning, they had some things not go their way as well.
Refs should be allowed. They should get one card every game. Each ref, they should have a card where they're like, it's that was awesome card. You know, that wasn't legal, but I'm going to throw the flag. We'll make it a flag. I think some ref should have jumped in there and been like, I'm throwing my flag. That was awesome, because that should have counted. It was just so... He made it look like he really meant to do it. He made it look easy that it was a crazy horse shot. Yeah.
Well, there you have it. Jim Larrañaga and the Miami Hurricanes make the Final Four. And I got a list of coaches that have done this because this is coaches that have taken two schools to the Final Four. You got Roy Williams, you got Lute Olson, you got Jack Gardner, you got Forty Anderson, Larry Brown, Eddie Sutton, John Calipari, Lou Henson, Bob Huggins, Frank McGuire, Lee Rose. And guess what they all have in common? They're blue bloods. So shout out to Jim Larrañaga. He's officially a blue blood coach. He's not at a blue blood program, but he's a blue blood coach. So congratulations to him.
Was Rick Pitino in there? Did you say Rick Pitino?
Yeah, I think I did. Rick Pitino is in there. Yeah, there you go. So
never want to short him credit ever.
Well,
on this show.
I think in this list that I pulled up, officially he's not because of the 2013 asterisks. You know what I mean? You know how this goes. So yes, Rick Pitino is obviously in there. We all know that. So there you go. Miami makes the Final Four. The first game of the day was fascinating as well. This was a defensive battle, to say the least. We got the Creighton Blue Jays taking on San Diego State. We have three teams that have never made the Final Four in the Final Four. That just shows how insane this tournament has been so far. Both teams in this game, San Diego State and Creighton, looking for their first Final Fours after making their first Elite Eights in program history. So a lot on the line, you know, a lot of back and forth in this game. It came down to the end to some drama with the foul call. But I want to talk about, just to start this, just Creighton and San Diego State. What did you see from Creighton in the first half? I mean, it felt like the game was being played at their pace a little bit. Kalkbrenner was getting a lot of lobs, a lot of offensive rebounds. Felt like the Blue Jays looked to be the team that was going to make it happen. Second half starts. San Diego State goes on a 6-0 run. They get a nice lob to Mensa, which kind of was, in my mind, the answer to Kalkbrenner to say, hey, we can go vertical too. We'll match fire with fire kind of thing. And then from there, I mean, it just felt like things got really tight for Creighton, and they played San Diego State basketball. What did you see, Kyle Mann, in this game, and what was your big takeaway?
I mean, it's another game that came down to an odd momentum point. You know, San Diego State did start to sort of take over and impose their will with their wheel. I almost did my really heavy Kentucky draw there. Impose their wheel. Creighton started out the game doing what they wanted to do. Nimhard and Trey Alexander were getting into the lane at will, and they really were killing. They did this throughout the game. You know, and it's smart. You know, you see some teams do this. The Suns have done this with Booker. OKC does this a little bit with Josh Giddey sometimes, where they'll get these guys into these two and three man actions where they were running this pin down for Baylor Shireman, where he would come down out of the corner and then Kalkbrenner was rolling. Well, we know that Shireman can shoot that shot. We know that he can hit that floater. You know, Booker and Ayton specifically it's been an ATM play for them. Mm-hmm. I think that I need to go back and watch the tape, but like, I think they ran that specific play 10 times, Tate. I'm not even kidding. And like I think Kalkbrenner scored on four of them, and then Shireman finally hit like a floater that was working for them. But I think a key thing for Creighton, you have to point this out, is that like when Nimhard hit his wrist and he did not stop flexing that thing for the rest of the game, clearly bothered by it, tried to come back into the game. He is their stabilizer. He dictates pace. He's probably the only guard on their roster that can consistently dictate pace. We talked about that awesome starting lineup. He's the crux of it, man. And right. when he was rattled, you know, he got the ball up the court, but I was telling you, he ate up like 10 or 11 seconds of clock every single time, and he was still on his heels with that pressure from San Diego State.
Yeah, and Trammell was picking him up. As soon as he saw, I think it was about 10 minutes to play in the second half, he has the wrist injury or hand injury, whatever it is, and Trammell was picking him up, and like you said, you take 10 seconds off the clock, he gets over half court, and all of a sudden, they're just pressing to get something to work, and around that same time, I thought one of the biggest underrated plays in the game, and after the game, of course, Greg McDermott brought it up, was Kalkbrenner gets a flagrant one foul on Mensa, where he kind of wraps his arm around, throws him down. He tells the ref goes to the monitor, reviews it. As you review it, you see that it is, you know, it looks pretty bad. It looks like Kalkbrenner did throw him down. But that was a big momentum shifter in my mind in the game. Creighton was very upset about that.
That was the same sequence.
Yes.
That was the same sequence, right? Like right. With Nimhard and that sequence shifted the game. Sorry, continue.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, that is something where everyone wants to talk about the foul at the end of the game, obviously, of course, and we'll get to that. But I thought that flagrant one was, you know, the moment. And then Trammell came down. He hit a floater to give SDSU a 46-45 lead with about 6:45 to play. And I mean, from there, it just felt like Creighton got a little bit tight. I've seen this with this team at times where the moment, they're so aware of the history that's ahead of them. This is why Baylor Shireman and all these guys are at Creighton, right, to make some history for Creighton. That's the dream that Greg McDermott has kind of sold all these guys. So I just felt like they felt the pressure. And then for whatever reason, San Diego State, they just kept, you know, they were just locked in. And this was the type of game that they wanted to play. The only moment where they kind of showed, you know, for lack of a better word, their ass a little bit was the inbounds play where, you know, they're up 56-54 late in the game. They try to throw, I mean, you never throw it towards your own basket. And the inbounds pass literally could not have been more of a perfect pass to Baylor Shireman. In fact, if you watched it without seeing who threw it, you would think it was a Creighton pass. He ties it at 56-56.
It did look like a Creighton pass.
Right. It looked like a play that they would have ran. I mean, honestly. So Shireman gets the steal, gets the finish. We're tied at 56-56. And then we get to the end of the game, which is, very controversial. A lot of people have talked about this. But Darian Trammell, who has been amazing in this tournament, he was great in this game as well. He gets a handoff. There were some questions if feet were shuffled before the handoff. The Aztecs were looking a little shook there at the end of the game, but whatever. Trammell gets the ball. He drives down. He kind of short arms the floater, but upon review there's a whistle. Upon review there's a left hand, Nimhard's left hand is on his hip. They call the foul. We get two free throws. Shireman looks at the ref. He's like, come on, you haven't called that all game and you call it now. All we ask for in college basketball is consistency. I didn't really like the call because I thought the whole game was very physical and there was a lot of hands on hips on many a shots and many a drives all night. But also, upon review, when you see the tape, he does have his hand on his hip, so there is contact. So by definition, it is a foul. What were your thoughts on that? And, obviously, I hate it for Creighton, but also, I mean, it is what it is. This is college basketball, and these things happen.
First of all, just on the basketball level, I was a little confused by the way Nimhard played him. The first time I saw it, I was like, okay, he's pushing him left. Is he, like, or is he trying to just, keep him... In my opinion, in that situation, I don't think you worry about like directional preference. I think you stay in front of him and like just guard your yard and like just keep him out of the lane. Any middle there is bad, whether he's going left or right. And, the moment that Trammell beat him, Nimhard started like grabbing. He's before the foul even happened, Nimhard started guarding with his hands. He was already, you could tell he was in trouble. He knew he was in trouble. Trammell goes up in the air and he's shooting that ball. He had his hand up on his hip and Creighton that subsequently will dip. I'm sorry for that joke. We're going to keep moving. But it's hard to know if he like affected. Do you even know that song, Tate? I'm older than you. I put your hand up on my. I got it.
I'm not saying okay, it clicked like two beats after the fact. That's why I maybe laughed a little bit late, but I got it. Don't worry.
I appreciate that pretending there. I know Kyle knows that song. Anyway, I'm sure that's on Touch Tunes at the Frolic Room. But
for sure.
So it's hard to know if he affected the shot. For me, I was just kind of like moving from there. I thought he guarded him a little odd. I don't know that the shot would have like gone in. But I thought that they were going to have a chance to maybe move on and, move to overtime, so San Diego State, if you're talking about like the spirit versus the letter of the law type argument here, which is going to transition to my next favorite part about this, which was the subsequent analysis that was going on CBS on the panel. I've never heard Clark Kellogg raise his voice the way he did did you hear that section where Kellogg was talking about the play? And he legitimately raised his voice. I'm going to pull the clip and put it on Twitter. He was annoyed by it. And you just heard all the kind of different, I don't know. You hear some people sometimes when like in a pickup game, you'll hear different philosophies about like, oh, I don't call anything. I call everything. There is this like thing outside of the letter of the law that basketball people talk about where it's like, don't call this in this situation. Even in unorganized basketball, you have that. It was really cracking me up to hear the panel discuss it, after the game.
Yeah, Charles Barkley and I we had the exact same opinion, which is always, sometimes I feel really good about that. Sometimes I start to question my own opinions. But, I mean, he kind of just said that situationally, you don't call that there. And I don't even know if it's situationally you don't call it. I just think it's consistency, like I said before. I mean, all game long, San Diego State, they have their hands literally holding jerseys of Creighton and Creighton vice versa because that's how the game was being called. And I'm not saying that's why Nimhard had his hand on his hip. I think he was more freaking out about getting beat. And that's why he did that. It was more of a, oh, shit, kind of thing. But to bring it back to the letter of the law, the letter of the law says it was a foul. It was a foul. San Diego State, Trammell goes to the free throw line. He makes the second one. They get the lead. Baylor Shireman then tries to throw a Johnny football pass, for lack of a better word. I mean, tries to throw a full court pass to Kaluma. I'm not really sure what that was. Gets tipped out of bounds. The refs look at it. They say the clock started late. They go to the stopwatch. They say game over. I don't like when they go to the stopwatch. I really don't, because there's a human element to the clock where when they start the clock, there's a human element to it that I like. I think that's good for college basketball. It keeps that human, connection to the game. But regardless of that, I mean, Creighton, it was game over as soon as he went to the free throw line, right? That's what it felt like. It felt like Creighton wasn't even running anything in that last play. I understand why McDermott was upset after the game. It was fun to see Dutcher. He's like a... Dutcher's a very funny character. Like, I, you know, being around him in Maui, he's like a goober, you know, that's probably the best word for him. He's just kind of like funny and but like in a dad kind of way, you know, where he makes these little comments and you're like, are you being for real? And he's like so pure in it. And the funniest thing to me after the game, they're cutting down the nets, right? San Diego State is. Brian Dutcher literally does a trust fall on his team, you know, and and it's so funny because he told us in Maui, he's like, yeah, our whole team before the season started, we all did trust falls with each other to get each other's trust. And I was like, what is this?
Corniest like, youth group shit. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm like, what is going on? Like, what is this? The Office, right? Like, what is happening? But the fact that like he did that, but it was so genuine and pure, right? That his teammates or, you know, his team and his coaches, and they all know it's coming from a good place. I just thought that was like a nice full circle moment for Brian Dutcher. I'm excited for Brian Dutcher and San Diego State. And if you're the Pac-12, you got to call San Diego State tonight. You got to be like, we need you guys in our conference because we can't get, you know, we got UCLA and USC leaving. And we need someone else that can get to the Final Four. You guys just proved that you can. So let's make it happen. And one other note on San Diego State, which I thought you would enjoy this, Kyle, man. Because they're Jordan brand, they can't wear Kawhi Leonard shoes. Because he's New Balance now. And when they signed the Jordan deal, Kawhi was obviously Jordan brand, but I think the deal runs up in 2025, and then there'll be New Balance probably if Kawhi makes that happen. But it's funny that like a lot of these players probably would want to wear Kawhi's shoes because of that, you know, relationship. He goes down to San Diego a lot. He's been in practices and all these types of things. So I thought it was funny. And then I saw Jason Tatum tweeting about how honored he was that San Diego State was wearing his shoes. And I was like, well, a little caveat here. I think they would probably wear Kawhi's shoes, but they can't.
It's sweet how excited Jason Tatum is about having his own shoe. It feels like really genuine. Anytime he talks about it, I'm just like, I think it's kind of charming. But also quickly, I like a lot of the New Balance basketball stuff. I just want to throw that out there. But the flip side of this, you know, not that San Diego State really as a brand is ready to replace a USC and a UCLA. There's a lot of years there and a lot of decades. But the flip side of this is just really, really one of the more heartbreaking you know, it's like kudos and you give credit to San Diego State for sure. They've played good basketball. It's incredible that they're in the Final Four. I don't know who picked this Final Four. If anyone did, I don't think anyone did. But for Creighton, this is tough, man, because they led, you know, the last lead that San Diego State had was at 16-15 in the first half. And they didn't lead again until the second half. At the 6:44 mark left in the game where they went up 46-45. Creighton, you do everything right. You play a great game. I thought Kalkbrenner did a great job playing and drop. He did a great job not committing fouls. I thought that his fatigue, I thought his fatigue was going to play a factor down the stretch. You watch him trying to go for some of those buckets in the lane. I thought fatigue was a factor for him there. It was just tough. You just felt it. I don't know. You see a lot of teams lose in March over the years, but this one just felt like a real dagger for where they're headed. You know, I don't know. Feel bad for Creighton fans.
I do too, and especially because the bracket kind of broke for Creighton a little bit. And the good news if you're a Creighton fan is all the guys, your starting five, all have eligibility left. Right, they can all come back, and I think there's a chance that maybe that happens. We'll see. Also, the one knock on Creighton all year was that they didn't have depth. And that kind of showed itself in this game. You could see that they were gassed. You could see guys pulling at their shorts. And San Diego State was just making things happen. And, you know, shout out to San Diego State. We feel for Creighton.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
We're going to quickly just run through the games on Saturday. You know, the big story, obviously, is that the FAU Owls ousted the most lovable player in the entire tournament, Marquise Noel. And the most interesting thing in this game to me was that FAU decided, weirdly, and I think UConn kind of did this the same way with Gonzaga. They said, okay, you may have the best player on the court, but we're going to make him beat us. You know what I mean? Like, he's going to have to do it himself, and especially scoring, right? They were like, Marquise Noel, you're going to have to score to beat us, and you're going to have to do it by yourself. He was still incredible in this game, but as soon as Brian Greenlee was forcing him left later in the second half, that started to cause some problems for him. They started to force things a little bit. And if you watch the post game, Jerome Tang went in the locker room with FAU and he said, you guys are the toughest team we've played all year. I think you guys could win the whole thing. And, you know, I thought that really that spoke volumes to me. And it also says, you know, as much as FAU is this Cinderella, they were an AP top 25 team. They've won 35 games. They have a lot of talent. Let's focus on FAU because Kansas State had a great year. Jerome Tang, coach of the year. We know all that. But what did you see from FAU in this game, Kyle, man, that you said, wow, I'm impressed with the Owls?
I think you hit on it. And in basketball in the last few years, we've had this kind of broader argument about heliocentrism versus, like, you know, spreading it out, like multifaceted offenses, basically just meaning, you know, can an offense go the distance if it's relying on one player past a certain point? You know, it's the arguments against Luka and, you know, all guys like this. Giannis ran up against this, Jokic's. This FAU attack is a young, which I think is important to note. We've been talking about experience wins, and that's been a through line of this tournament. Florida Atlantic has five sophomores in their top eight, and they just have multiple handlers that have interchangeability. You know, we talked a lot about, like, John L. Davis, who has almost like a Lance Stevenson start-stop kind of quality to his game. I love watching him. He just seems like he would be a real pain in the ass to guard. But they have a lot of guys who are, like, really interchangeable, like closeout attackers, guys that can handle the ball. They have five guys in their rotation that are 34% or higher from three. And I just think that over the course of this game, you know, Marquise Noel was unbelievably entertaining throughout this thing, but Florida Atlantic just kept coming. They out-rebounded them in this game 44-22. So you got a lot of aim small, miss small. You saw, like, Kansas State firing a lot of bullets, trying to stay in this game. And Florida Atlantic, just with their team attack, just kept coming. And I don't know, it felt like the ending that wasn't as fun. Like, you wanted to see the cardiac Kemba thing keep going. But it just seemed like it ran up against a wall. There were some, and I had one note that I thought had a funny sort of, like, cyclical quality to it. Was at the beginning of the game, Noel threw the ball to Masood, who has hit, like, daggers throughout this tournament. And Masood looked really uncomfortable off the dribble. And I wrote down in my notes, I was like, Masood, pretty vulnerable off the dribble. Last play of the game, it had like a Ted Lasso quality where you're just like, is Jamie going to shoot the game-winning shot because he's been the man all season? And he passes it to Masood, and Masood is way too far from the basket. He gets trapped, dribbles the ball once, turns it over, end of the run for Kansas State. So Florida Atlantic moves on.
And there's a lot of people that were giving Noel, you know, grief about passing that ball there. But he and Masood had been playing with each other since they were kids, apparently, at Rucker Park. They knew each other well. So he apparently had enough faith in him, thought he was the better shooter. So I understand his thought process in making that decision. I thought these stats were interesting about FAU. They were 11-1 in games decided by 5 points or less. That was second in the country this season behind Mizzou. Shout out to Mizzou. And also, they're 27-1 when they have a halftime lead. And when they went in with the lead at halftime, I saw that stat and I said, oh, well, that does not bode well for Kansas State. Then after the game, Dusty May, I'm guessing he was talking about us because we did our Elite Eight power rankings. We had FAU as the eighth team. We both did. He said, this is after, you know, they beat Kansas State. They're going to the Final Four. He said, I expect the prognosticators to pick us fifth in the Final Four. So I will say this, Dusty May, I will not pick you fifth. That is a guarantee for me. I may pick you fourth, but I won't pick you fifth, that's for sure. But a great game for FAU. Great moment. Marquise Noel, you know, we call him the ultimate Kimba candidate, but like you said, he's more of a passer than Kimba ever was. You know, I mean, the assists that this guy were making were incredible. And he was doing it when guys were staying home and not coming to help, right? I mean, he's still making amazing passes on ridiculous cuts and things like that. I thought Tomlin had a great run. I feel like he's a prospect that will get some intrigue and some interest from the NBA at some point. But my big takeaway is that Kansas State's a very likable team. I really think that they're a very, very likable group. I think Jerome Tang is one of the most likable coaches in America. And he showed that after the game, like I said, going and telling FAU that they're one of the best teams in the country. All right, the final game that we're going to hit here in the Elite Eight, this was yesterday. This was the second game of the day. And maybe this game is the reason why I was so sick and so thrown for a loop because, you know, I just felt it completely out of it. I was asleep for most of this game, but I didn't miss much because UConn, as they did in the non-conference, they absolutely dominated. I mean, absolutely dominated. I mean, the Zags started 1-for-8 from the field. They were down 9-2 to Connecticut, and it just felt like UConn never looked back in this game. Sanogo was great when they doubled. He made some amazing passes. The passing of UConn in general is next level. Caravan is a great piece for them in that four spot because he can stretch the floor. He's like a great stretch four for them. I just think UConn is fascinating with the way that they share the basketball, with the depth that they have, with the size that they have. Klingon was great in this game. And I was worried about Drew Timmy going up against these bigs. And with foul trouble and things like that, UConn absolutely dominated. And now guess what, Kyle, man? We got Bill Murray in the Final Four, which is what we all wanted.
That's what everybody wants. Old Billy Boy in the Final Four, finally. I don't think he didn't get one when he was cheering for U of L like a sinner. But no, this game, the passing, like you said, was incredible. It just, you got the sense that like, and you heard this a little bit from Creighton too, from Coach McDermott that, and you know, Hurley said this too, that like they had a moment where, you know, they started strong and then they had to come kind of regroup at some point during the year where they were like, we know we're a good team. Hurley said that he was like yelling and fighting with his guys a lot and that he just stopped doing that. But the passing throughout this game was amazing. It just felt like, you know, UConn's cohesiveness and connectedness on offense on both sides of the ball. They had incredible rim pressure with Sanogo. I think Donovan Klingon has established himself as like a legitimate pro. My certainty that he's going to be an NBA player has just skyrocketed over the course of this tournament.
He's Naquan got Tomlin great IQ too, Kyle, man. One thing I wanted to point out was there was one play where Timmy drives, he misses a layup, but he's on the ground. Like, you know, he's behind the play and Klingon just sprinted the floor and they ended up getting a dunk and an and one. And that was a perfect example of like, this guy is smart. This guy gets it. And he runs the court like Tyler Zeller. That's who he reminds me of. I mean, when you see seven footers that have that kind of ability to run the floor, I mean, Tubelis does this at Arizona as well, but that strikes you. That stands out to you, and Klingon has that quality.
And he's way bigger than Zeller, too. He's gigantic. Something we got to give credit to Andre Jackson in that game. He had just an absolutely phenomenal basketball game. He had one play. I tweeted this out. You can go find it on my Twitter at JCalman. There was a play, I forget if it was Newton, but there was a pick and roll where he got trapped. Maybe he didn't expect the trap to come. He was trapped on like the left side. He throws a roller pass to Klingon, I believe. And Jackson is in the right corner along the baseline. And he sees that the pass is going to be short. And Caravan is just above him on the right side of the three-point line. He sprints basically to intercept the pass. The ball bounces really early, probably bounces around like the top of the key. Gets the ball in one motion, whips it to the opposite side to Caravan for a wide open three. It was a very Draymond-y kind of a play. But they just looked It was amazing because like Jordan Hawkins throughout this night, he had a great night. He looked effortless out there. I had somebody compare him to Isaiah Joe. I've said Bryn Forbes. He just has this floating kind of way about him. The crazy thing is, man, he doesn't have to force it. All Hawkins has to do is just be himself and pull gravity. You have to respect him because of how fast he shoots it. I love an off-screen three, Tate. If there was a vape flavor called off-screen three, I would take a hit of that every night before bed. UConn just looked dominant, man. Do you see anybody beating them right now? I mean, they're playing better than anybody. I don't think there's any question.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, the team that I was excited to see play them because of their bench and their depth was Texas. Like, Texas had the bench, I thought, to match up with the matchups of UConn. I thought that that would be like a great chess match between those two coaches. So the fact that we're not getting that is fascinating and will be interesting. I'm worried about Omir, same thing as Timmy, getting in foul trouble with these bigs. And look, UConn's the only team that's won a national championship in the Final Four, and I think that they should be the favorite. Not because of that, but I think that also adds a certain level of we're supposed to be here, we belong here, we expect to win here. And Dan Hurley's been preaching that all season to this team. I mean, they had their little skid in conference play, and they had like a players-only meeting. We love players-only meetings. That things change when you have those. And since then, they've just been the team that we saw in non-conference, and they beat everybody by double digits. That's what they did in the non-conference. That's why they were number one in the country, right? So they just look like the team that we saw at the start of the year. I think Tristan Newton, I think the ball handlers and the responsibility of initiating the offense has been spread out a lot with this UConn team, so you never know where you're getting your hits coming from. And if they can play inside out, they have the shooters for it, I really think that they're going to be tough to knock out. And I wouldn't be shocked if UConn comes away with a national championship. And every single stat you see is like, first time UConn's done this since 2014. It's like, what happened that year? First time UConn's done this since 2011. What happened that year? First time UConn's done this since 2004. What happened that year? And look, me personally, I'm partial because 1999 UConn, when they beat Duke, Duke was, in my opinion, they were destined to go. They were 37-1 on their way to a title. So when Jim Calhoun did that, he also beat Gonzaga in the Elite Eight that year, funny enough, and in the West region. So there's some connective tissue there. But yeah, I just think UConn has checked all the boxes. I really, like I've been saying the entire tournament, Dan Hurley does concern me a little bit as a coach, but he seems like he's gotten it together. He did have, with about 4 minutes to go, they cut to him. He did the, what the F are we doing? And he did like the big pout, you know, that he always does. Yeah. That was a little bit of a, there's Dan Hurley that I know. But for the most part, they got it together. They got a great team. And the painting that he did for Luke Murray that they showed, I thought that showed some humility on the part of Dan Hurley, and
he was willing to admit that. Yeah,
yeah, right. The fact that he was willing to do that seems very out of character from what you expect. So, to me, it's all signs are pointing to UConn, but this tournament, nothing has made sense so far, so you can't really say that. But if you had to pick a team right now as the favorite in the Final Four, I think Connecticut checks all the boxes.
Yeah, a couple just like bullet points here that I think are important. You mentioned UConn in 99. UConn is on the verge. If they do pull this off, they will have one in 99 and in 04, and then they'll have the ones in 11 and 14, obviously. That would be five titles since 1999 with three different coaches, which is unprecedented. That's not happened. Right. That hasn't happened in Kentucky, UCLA, North Carolina, any of these blue-blooded schools. They're kind of doing the Duke thing in a way that we don't really give. You know, they don't have the same kind of pedigree. I guess it's because they've had some of the dip. You know, they left their conference and things like that. This is the end of the Drew Timmy era. You know, Drew Timmy picking up that fourth foul on the stupid discard. I don't care if it was a foul or not. I don't have a lot of sympathy for people who box out with their hands. It was just a stupid play. But for Gonzaga, season low in points at 54. Their previous low is 63 against Baylor on December 2nd. Mm. And this is a team also that Texas crushed. I just think the end of the Timmy era is a significant thing, Tate. You know, the bigs, they weren't the bigs that we thought. You know, we had all this attention on these name bigs. Bigs have mattered, just not the ones that we thought.
Yeah, and I still think that there's a chance that Drew Timmy comes back. I really do. He has one more year of eligibility. Everyone wants to write him off, but I think he could come back. So shout out to the bigs. Also, one big shout out before we get out of here. I want to shout out Rick Pitino, because Rick Pitino was leading UConn at halftime. I'm like, you know what I mean?
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Look how UConn has absolutely blitzed every. I mean, granted, they ended up winning by double digits, but their average margin of victory is 22.5 points right now. And Rick Pitino led them at halftime with Iona. So shout out to Rick Pitino. That's my big shout out.
It's kind of like when Captain America grabbed Thanos' fist for a second and Thanos, you saw his eyes get serious, you know, and you were like, oh, Thanos is going to crush him. But, you know, Captain America, you know, Rick Pitino is Captain America, Tate. It's kind of the point I'm making. He's America's coach. We love him. I just, you know, I think that he needs all the credit. We'd never want to short him credit and seize every opportunity to give him credit.
Right. And that's it. All right. Well, that's been the Elite Eight. All the coaches say the Elite Eight is the hardest round to win in the NCAA tournament because it's the midway point. It's the time that you can say, OK, we've done our duty here. We've made it far enough to get our respect. But you really got to keep fighting. And then it's a whole nother tournament once you get to Houston. So shout out to all the teams that made it. Got three teams for the first time in the Final Four. We got UConn back in the Final Four. That's good for basketball. I know that the haters out there will say, well, no one's going to watch that Final Four. Check the TV ratings, Who cares? It's going to be good basketball. These are really good basketball teams. I could talk myself into any of the four winning the championship, even though I think UConn, like I said, is the favorite. So that's fun. Kyle, man, anything else before we get out of here? Because Kyle, our producer Kyle, has to go do Ryan Rosillo and Bill Simmons. So we got to get out of here ASAP.
Priorities, Kyle. I mean, seriously, which one's more important, this show or Bill Simmons and Ryan Rosillo? I'm just saying. It pains me that Justin Verrier is happy right now. He's one of my mortal enemies, Justin Verrier. So I'm just going to, it's a terrible day for me that my enemies are having a great day. But I love college basketball. I'm sure we can have a more of a conversation about De'Aaron Fox and the bickering that's going on within the basketball world. Like, college basketball is terrible. The shot making. You know, we can talk about that. Maybe my little voice there indicates how I feel about this already. Right. But I'm excited about the Final Four because I always am, and I cannot wait. And to talk about it with you, Tate.
Yeah, me too. We're going to do like a Final Four preview in the middle of the week next week. So get ready for that. Myself, Kyle Mann, we'll break down the matchups. We'll look at these four teams more in detail. This is more the reaction of what we just saw, trying to digest it all. I appreciate everyone out there listening, putting up with my voice, putting up with my sickness. I'm sorry I couldn't do a show last night, but hopefully this, it was enough to kind of, you know, get you there, get you fired up. A lot of UConn fans were mad at me, Kyle. They thought I was dodging the show. Not dodging the show. Hopefully my voice shows I'm not dodging the show. Shout out to producer Kyle. Shout out to my amazing guest, co-host Kyle Mann for sticking with me and making it possible. This is One Shining Podcast. We got a Final Four. It's going to be in Houston. It's going to be fun. Can't wait to talk about it all with everyone, all the friends of the program. This is One Shining Podcast, and we will see you early in the week.